Welcome back to Transform, a podcast highlighting the people and ideas shaping the future of senior living. I'm Austin Montgomery for Senior Housing News. On today's episode, I spoke with Solera Senior Living CEO Adam Kaplan. The Denver, Colorado-based provider operates 9 communities nationwide with additional sites under development. Solera will continue to grow in 2024 and beyond through acquisitions, management contract additions, and new development. This coincides with the company's push into value-based care to improve resident health outcomes and overall senior living operations.
Figure out how to balance your day-to-day priorities with a longer-term strategy on how do we evolve our care model.
Now, here's my interview with Solera CEO, Adam Kaplan. Adam, thanks so much for joining us here on Transform.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think a great place to start. Would you just maybe describe the year from an operations perspective? What's 2024 been like? And then we'll dive into some of the dynamics of value-based care growth and just what's ahead for Solera.
Yeah, awesome. I actually was trying to reflect a little bit before our call, and I actually reverted back to the predictions that I made to start this year. And one of the predictions that I made was that we need to shift our thinking so that we can thrive in 25, not survive in 25. And I actually would say that I think we're further along on that path than I would have expected entering 2024. And the reason is because there was so much adversity that we dealt with as an industry in the last few years. And most people think it starts with 2020. I'll actually take it back a year further to 19. We're dealing with oversupply. There was very, very inexpensive capital. There was a surplus of capital on the sidelines flowing into commercial real estate. And so there was a lot of new units that were delivered in a short time period that was ahead of the demand wave. Then obviously 2020 started and we dealt with the pandemic. And that was the start of a very, very challenging 4-year stretch. 2020, we were constantly recalibrating, trying to institute new protocols to keep residents safe. 2021, we had a staffing crisis, and it was challenging to get people to show up on the front lines to do the work that we needed to deliver on our commitment to our residents. And then we experienced this extreme unprecedented wage escalation, which created margin contraction. Then in 2022, we experienced a capital markets collapse. And the effect of that carried through into 2023 and still is playing out in 2024. Right. What I would say, though, is that in the last 6 months in particular, maybe 12 months, we've started to experience occupancy growth, RevPOR growth, and we've started to see some stabilization of wage expansion. And we've seen some of the day-to-day pressures that we were dealing with in terms of like the clinical demands that were yielding a lot of burnout and fatigue among both the frontline and the management that some of those pressures have eased a little bit. And so the climate is a lot more tenable. And in fact, now for the first time in a long time, you can have not only these, operational wins, but you can even have some financial wins to go along with it to just validate that, the steps that you've made, the decisions that you've made along the way, are the right decisions for all the stakeholders, for residents, for families, for our team members. So for companies that I think didn't overextend themselves in this last cycle, that were thoughtful about their growth, that played the long game, that understood that ultimately we were going to get to the other side of this. And if you could, you know, invest in your infrastructure, if you could, you know, sacrifice a little bit in the short term during those times in terms of, you know, the financial side of the equation, that ultimately you would reap the benefits of it. And now, you know, we're in this period of expansion as a company where we're seeing a lot of interesting growth opportunities. I think that are, you know, a reward for good decision making over the last 5 years. I predicted that we should thrive in 25, and I think that again that the some of the positives that we were trying to achieve that were a bit aspirational in the fourth quarter of 2023, I think that while the capital markets environment is still challenging, I think for good operators, good real estate investors, good assets and good markets, those properties are able to access you know, debt financing, refinance, get to the other side, and then participate in some of the growth opportunities that we've all been hoping would materialize in the last few years.
Right. And I think that's a great way to summarize kind of the ways that the industry more broadly, at least operators who have positioned themselves to be successful, have been able to execute in the last, I'd say, 18 to 24 months. Do you want to highlight some of the new growth plans or just what growth could look like for Solera and what's ahead? Because I know obviously we'll talk value-based structures here in a moment. But do you want to just highlight some of the opportunities that you're seeing out there? I know you're probably thinking about new growth and that might look differently than what it did maybe last year or 2 years prior. But when you're thinking about new growth plans, anything you want to touch on just there? I would love to get your perspective.
Yeah. So for those that aren't that familiar with Solera, we focus in the early days on development, specifically building in high barrier to entry locations and building Class A properties that were more contemporary in terms of the design, more of a focus on hospitality. And we really leaned into technologies so that we could deliver a better resident experience. We've refocused, though, our growth strategies today on three areas primarily. One is acquisitions. Two is third-party management for experienced institutional investors. And then three is management platform acquisitions. Within the acquisitions, we're focused on two types of acquisitions. One is core plus and the other is light value add. And what we're staying away from is very distressed deals. Those are opportunities that can make a lot of financial sense if you're purely looking at it from an investment perspective. But what we've realized is that it can put a real strain on the management company because you have to devote such an outsized number of resources to trying to turn that asset around, especially if it's you know, clinical regulatory issues. And those problems quickly become your problems. So memory's short, and whether it's an investor that's, you know, making a management change or it's a new acquisition, it doesn't take very long before you inherit those problems and those become your problems. So we're trying to focus on properties that are architecturally relevant, that are well designed, that are in good markets with good underlying demographics, where the properties are either performing well and well positioned for the long term, or where we feel like there's a path to stabilization. So it could be that you know, it's managed by an operator that grew too quickly and this was outside of their focus area. Maybe it was a geography that they didn't have a presence. Maybe they typically do joint ventures and this was just a third-party management deal. Some unique circumstances. it could be that it's not a good time to sell, but there's a motivated seller because of a debt maturity or a fund maturity, or in certain cases, the equity is just, you know, had a bad experience investing in senior living. They invested at the wrong time and they just want to get out of the sector. So it could be that, you know, we're taking advantage of the time. It could be that they opened in 19 and 20 and they were in a market that was very, very challenging. And that they had to close the front door. And so they were dealing with attrition and got really behind in their lease up. And, you know, it could be that they dealt with a lot of oversupply in a short term. And so it's taking time for that demand wave to catch up and to absorb the supply. So we are seeing some really interesting opportunities on the acquisition side. But again, more core plus, light value add, newer vintage, larger 100 plus units in primary and large secondary markets.
I wanted to ask, is there a specific geographic region? Anything you're looking at specifically?
No. There isn't a specific geographic region. You know, in the early days, I launched in 2016. And in the early days, there was a lot of people that questioned that strategy. And they really pushed back on how we were building the platform. They suggested that it couldn't be done. You know, you had to be geographically focused. Go, you know, build or buy in Denver. And then maybe when you've proven the success there, you can expand in New Mexico. You know, candidly, like the way that I viewed it was that actually worked well in this industry when the industry wasn't as mature. And I think if you're trying to build a really high caliber management company, it's challenging because it actually dilutes your brand. Those opportunities, when you're so geographically concentrated, don't allow you to really leverage your core competency. So what I mean by that is if you're going into Denver specifically, you might have to do a primary market and a secondary market and a tertiary market. Maybe you're doing a new development, and then maybe you're doing an acquisition of a 1985 vintage property. Then maybe you're doing a deal that's 150 units and maybe one that's 50 units and a standalone memory care. Well, I think what we've seen in the industry is that operators typically aren't good at managing all different types of assets. So we know we're a lot better when we're operating assets in markets where you can really differentiate your product. You can deliver a more premium experience. You can deliver better hospitality. You can provide more innovative technologies. You could push the healthcare integration strategy and drive better health outcomes. What we really try to avoid as a company, because we're not as good with these types of properties, are properties that are commoditized, where you need to run as efficiently as possible. And we focus on properties where we can really elevate the experience for our residents and for the families. That's where we find where we can win. So because of that, we cast a wide net and we look at opportunities throughout the US as long as they're in a primary market, a large secondary market, and they are a direct flight from either Denver or call it one of our hubs. And see, one of the interesting things I'll add is that unlike in 16, 17, when I was building the strategy, our team is actually spread out throughout the US today. So it actually is very interesting because we just took on a building in Raleigh, North Carolina in the last 30 days, a new acquisition with Focus. And we have a VP of operations that is based in the Raleigh market. And then we got a call on another opportunity that was in the St. Louis market because our head of sales and marketing is based in St. Louis. So when people think of Solera, they don't think of us as a Denver-based operator. And they actually now look at our geographic footprint and they look at where our team's based and they say, okay, like you are likely to be more successful with this market because it's in close proximity to where one of your senior members of your ops team is based. The only market where we actually are proactively trying to expand in is the DC market. Today we have three properties. We're going to four. And Raleigh is actually close. It's actually about a 5-hour drive. And then we're working on an acquisition opportunity that is in the Pennsylvania market. So that's a area where there's really good demographics. There's a lot of density. The consumer's more educated and more willing to pay for a better product. So it really aligns with our brand competency. But outside of that, we're what I still continue to say, geographically agnostic. And we're just pursuing the best opportunities that align with our brand. In addition to acquisitions, we're also, we will third party manage for an institutional investor that has experience, is tested in the space. So somebody that really understands the business. And so when they're making an acquisition or making a change in management, they have realistic expectations for why the property is performing the way it is, and then what a new operator can bring to the table. And then lastly, a strategy that is very active today is the acquisition of a platform. And we're in active negotiation on one. We are pursuing a few others as well. And those are interesting because you could have a high quality platform. You have a founder who does not have a succession plan, which is, it actually makes a lot of sense in senior living. I think that I've said this before and I'll say it again. Senior living operators have had a difficult time attracting high quality talent. Most of the talent actually lies on the capital side of the business, the advisory side of the business, and even the vendor side of the business is doing an excellent job of attracting talent. Ops is a hard path. Oftentimes the compensations don't align with how challenging it is. And so there's a lot of operators where they were great entrepreneurs. They launched companies at the right time, but they just have failed to develop that succession plan. And they're at a stage where there's some burnout, there's fatigue. They don't want to go through another cycle. And so they're looking at a transition where they know that their people will be in good hands. There's cultural alignment. They know that the promises, the commitments that they've made to their LPs, that they can still carry those on because an operator like us has a similar philosophy about running the business as the way they do. So that's one of the opportunities we really like. And then there are some that are under that distress category that grew too fast and got overextended. And we'll look at those, but those are probably less likely than the other scenario where it's a really high quality platform. And it's almost like it's an honor that we have to be able to, carry on that legacy for that founder and kind of take that platform to the next generation.
And I think you're talking about this elevation and the ways you can go into a community and especially into a primary market and help elevate not only the resident experience, but also kind of improve the transparency on the capital side and really help build bridges in multiple ways. So I think this would be a great transition into discussing Solera's involvement in the value-based care effort. Do you maybe want to describe for our listeners how you're accessing that space? And then we'll dive into some of the other specifics. I'm generally thinking also too, talking about the Payvider relationship that we've talked about at length before, and then some of your other comments on risk and value-based care. So do you want to just give a summary of how Solera is accessing that space?
Yeah. So a number of years ago, we decided that we wanted to better integrate and coordinate healthcare services within our buildings. And so we set out to evaluate what our options were. And initially, we were having conversations with a Medicare Advantage plan. And what we ultimately decided was that we felt like within our buildings, it was going to be challenging to try to get our residents to switch their payer. One of the theories was that, Medicare Advantage is about 50% of the Medicare population, was that in our buildings, where we're located in these primary markets or large secondary markets. We have more educated clientele. We have a clientele that is a wealthier demographic, that the actual percentages of traditional Medicare would be significantly higher. So that many of our residents have not shifted from traditional Medicare to Medicare Advantage. So then we ultimately started to evaluate other options, and we decided that the best option for us was to align with a group called Curana Health. Curana is a payvider. They actually have Medicare Advantage plans, but they have what's called an ACO REACH. And the reason we were interested in aligning with the ACO REACH was that it would be payer agnostic. And we thought it would be easier to get our residents to switch their provider as opposed to their payer. And so what we did was we launched an in-community primary care clinic, first in our building in Austin, Texas, the Reserve. And then we expanded that, and we ultimately launched it in our building in Evanston as well. What we have found is that it's also challenging to get attribution to an ACO. And what I've heard from talking to people that are more progressive is that there's been more success with this model in rural markets as opposed to an urban market. The reason is because if you go to an urban market, you have high performing primary care providers that are engaged in these communities. Whereas if you go in a rural market, a lot of times the residents haven't had any communication with their primary care provider. So the value prop for a group like a Curana in a rural market is really, really compelling. Whereas if you go to a building like an Evanston or Austin, the incumbent providers will see Curana coming, and they can actually pretty quickly adjust their model to prevent residents from switching and also to continue to attract new residents upon admission. So what's a simple thing they can do? They can say, okay, we've been coming one day a week or 2 days a week, the nurse practitioner on site to see the residents. Well, now we're going to guarantee, we're going to commit that we're going to be there 4 days a week. So what I will say is this is good for the residents. This is good for the residents, and it's good for the families. All right. So competition promotes change, and it encourages even the incumbents who maybe weren't that well positioned to sit up a little bit taller and to deliver a better experience for our residents. That said, it's created a challenge in terms of driving the adoption to the preferred provider, driving the attribution. And so what you find is that you don't have all of your residents or majority of your residents signing up for the ACO, signing up to work with the primary care provider, and that you're seeing a mixed bag. And so I'm not discouraged. I'm actually encouraged with what is possible when this model evolves. And so what do I mean by that? Today, what you're seeing is that for the most part, you're offering a primary care provider that is an expert in caring for this senior population, high need senior population, that will offer an on-site presence. I think that ultimately the care model will evolve significantly. And what will that ultimately look like? My prediction is that it will be a hybrid model. It will be both in community as well as virtual. This is very, very important in senior living because you have to be able to provide this nurse practitioner primary care oversight not only during the day, but especially in the evenings and in overnight where you might have a more of a skeleton crew. And historically, the natural inclination is to just send that person out to the hospital, which we know is bad for everybody, right? It's bad for the residents, bad for the family, and it's really bad for the healthcare system because it's very, very costly. Most likely, when you send them out to the hospital, they're going to be admitted to the hospital. They're not just going to be in the ER, but they'll be admitted, and you know that's typically about a $20,000 event for the system. So it's very, very costly. So do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask, when you're thinking about integrating value-based care goals and especially value-based care growth into operations, we understand that it's very taxing on operations and that you need to really think about really evolving additional supports in staffing to really help drive this shift to value and this shift towards value-based care growth. So I want to get your perspective on just how you grapple to make the economic side of value-based care growth work with some capital partners' timelines who might be a bit shorter than what we talked about of that 5 to 10 year play for value-based care to actually take hold and for this shift to happen. So would love to get your perspective on how you kind of try to mirror those two timelines together, even though they're different, while also balancing operations.
Well, that's why the adoption of this is so slow. Because you don't have the care model. That's going to evolve tremendously so that you have a care model that is proven. And then you have the data to go along with it can actually demonstrate that in this setting, we can achieve better outcomes. And we'll just describe better outcomes as lower ER rates, lower hospitalizations, and lower long-term care utilization. So you need the right care model, the right partners that are high performing, and you need the data that you can demonstrate that in this setting, we can deliver better outcomes relative to other settings of care, which I strongly believe is possible in a community-based setting because we can influence both social and physical determinants of health in a community-based setting in the most efficient manner. And so I personally believe that it is a much better setting of care for a senior with high needs, which is typically who we're caring for, relative to the home. There's still going to be, the home is a setting of care that will be appropriate for people, but I believe that the community-based setting has been overlooked. And that with the integration of healthcare, with tracking the outcomes, that we can demonstrate that this is a setting of care that is a lower cost with better outcomes. Now, why is this so challenging? Is because real estate investors are the ones that are either investing 90% or 100% of the equity into a senior living asset. Real estate investors typically have a shorter investment horizon. And that's typically 3 to 5 years if you're a value add investor. Most of the investors in senior living are value add investors. If you're doing a development deal, it's going to mostly be a value add investor. If you're doing an acquisition and it's either a value add or distressed or a light value add, it's going to be a shorter term investor. Where you will see a longer term investor is where you get more into what's called core plus or core acquisitions, where you have a REIT that is acquiring an asset or a private equity fund that has, you know, either the core plus or the core mandate or a family office. And you're starting to see family offices invest directly into commercial real estate. And I do think that we'll start to see this asset class continue to mature, and that core capital will come into senior living in this next cycle even stronger than what we saw in the past cycles. But today, given that most of the capital is this value add capital, is got more of a 3 to 5 year outlook, they are looking for their investments to mature prior to when the benefits of value-based care will accrete to the assets. The other thing is you need to generate what's called a risk-adjusted return. So real estate investors, they're looking to invest in a property and are looking for assets that can generate certain occupancy gains, year-over-year growth in RevPOR that exceeds the year-over-year growth in expenses. And that is appropriate risk for the type of capital that they have. Value-based care is very unknown. And what are the financial benefits is very unknown. And so it gets outside of the box for the type of risk that a real estate investor wants to take. Now, there are some private equity firms that are investing in senior living that do both real estate and traditional private equity. And so when you talk to those teams, they actually will understand both real estate investments and they'll also understand healthcare growth equity. And so those types of firms might be more apt to take on the incremental risk if they feel that they can generate the appropriate return for the incremental risk that they're going to take on. So we at Solera don't have any outside investors in the company. And so we can balance how we deploy our resources. And we can focus on the day-to-day execution that helps to meet the expectations of our real estate investors while also positioning the company for the long term. And I personally believe that if we strike that balance correctly, that when we recapitalize the value add investors into a core plus or a core strategy, that the next investor is actually going to place greater value on our properties and our portfolio. And the investors that invest with us will realize the benefits of that. I also personally believe that there's a significant risk if you're an operator or an investor today and you aren't striking that balance, because I do think that it's foreseeable that real estate, that the healthcare referral patterns are going to be more aligned with who is delivering the best outcomes. And so if you're ignoring this strategy, you could actually see your occupancy suffer as a result of it. I don't think that's going to be, you know, in 2 years from now or 3 years from now. But I think in time, I believe that the referrers are going to be looking to see who's doing a good job, you know, who's actually reducing ER visits and reducing hospitalizations and long-term care utilization, and the referral patterns will flow more in that direction. So I understand the challenge of striking that balance. And I think a lot of operators, it could be smaller operators, B, it could be operators that overextended themselves. You only have so many resources. And especially if you're putting out a lot of fires, it might be challenging to strike that balance. Again, goes back to what I said earlier, which was that we're avoiding those distress situations because it'll strain the resources. And if we can buy higher quality properties that have good leadership teams, good cultures, that are providing good service, that aren't dealing with a bunch of regulatory issues, then we can make improvements in the operating model. And we can also not only focus on short-term results, but we can balance that with what we're trying to achieve in the long term.
And I think that's something that in terms of where we're headed is, like you had mentioned, there are some unknowns to the value-based care effort right now, because although we have seen a lot of growth in the last 4 years, I think there is still, like you had mentioned, a lot of that remains to be seen. So when you're thinking about your outlook for growth of value-based care and how it relates to the integration in senior living, what's ahead? What are you thinking about? What do you think is going to be driving this pivot to value-based care? What's your outlook? Because we know that it's a long-term play. So last question here, what's your outlook for value-based care and where do you see this all heading, at least in the short term right now, where we are?
So in the short term, what I think is that you're going to see more and more companies adopt some type of healthcare integration strategy, whether that's fee-for-service or value-based care. And that could be Guide and getting in the game with Guide. It could be aligning with a primary care provider. It could be aligning with a payer or a payvider. That's the first step. Then you're going to actually start asking yourself the question, how do we drive attribution? All right. How do we get more people signed up either for the payer or for the provider? And I think what you're going to need to drive attribution is the care model will need to evolve. And just a couple of things I want to say on that.
Yeah.
A, it needs to be a hybrid. It needs to be in-person and virtual. You need to have 24/7 virtual care. I personally believe that you need to integrate in mental health, behavioral health services. So many of our residents are in need of geriatric psych services. And so I think the best position primary care providers will integrate behavioral health into their care model. I think that you need to also include remote patient monitoring so that you can be more proactive in your care delivery. You know, you can detect somebody's resting heart rate, somebody's variable heart rate. So you can see if, you know, they've had a poor night's sleep. You can see if they have a respiratory disease like COVID. And you can put an intervention in place proactively. And then the other thing is wraparound services, and whether that's, you know, chronic care management or principal care management or programs like Guide, being able to compensate service providers to proactively and routinely touch the patients is important, because the primary care docs can only do so much. And so the fact that there's other incentives out there that allow you to stay in front of the patients more proactively, I think is going to be part of this holistic picture. So I think you need to develop a holistic plan, and you're going to need to do this in partnership with a group like a Curana. And there's going to be other providers out there that are going to come on the scene that are going to push this model forward. Then the next step, and this is kind of coinciding with it, you need to start tracking outcomes. You need to start to see, how are you doing? You might not like what you see, but start tracking it. Okay. You can't fix what you don't know. So like, how are you doing in terms of ER visits, and how are you doing in terms of hospitalizations, and how are you doing in terms of long-term care utilization? Obviously, there's other outcomes like falls and medication, you know, medication errors. Figure out what you want to track, start tracking that, and then figuring out how you can actually improve those outcomes. So aligning with a provider, evolving the care model, tracking outcomes, figuring out how do you actually positively influence those outcomes, that is to me where operators and investors should be focused in the next few years. Then in time, the financial benefits will follow. And the reason why I feel that that will happen is because I do believe that senior living is better positioned than almost all other care settings to deliver the best health outcomes for a high need senior population. And the reason is because senior living can influence social determinants of health, and physical health. And we can do it in a way that is more efficient relative to other settings of care. So get in the game. That's what I've said before. Get in the game. Don't anticipate some significant savings check that you're going to get from your ACO in terms of shared savings, you know, in the next year. Don't expect some big check in terms of like, you know, a fee for service dollars. Don't expect you're going to get some really high attribution day one. But like anything that is going to have a meaningful reward at the end of the day, it's going to take commitment. So figure out how to balance your day-to-day priorities with a longer-term strategy on how do we evolve our care model and how do we deliver a better experience for our residents, for our families, for our team members, and for our investors.
Well, Adam, I really appreciate your insights today. Thank you so much for joining us here on Transform.
You bet. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That does it for this episode of Transform. I'm Austin Montgomery for Senior Housing News. Thanks for listening.